Welcome to the SEO podcast, Unknown Secrets of Internet Marketing. My name is Chris Burris, one of the owners of EWR.
And my name is Matt Bertram, one of your SEO specialists.
Welcome back to another fun-filled edition of our podcast. We are so excited. Like we mentioned last time, we are in the presence of sunshine making glory. we're so excited to have Gary, and I've seen him on interviews. He kind of requests to not even attempt his last name, so I'm not going to. We've got Gary from Google. We're really excited to have this interview going. So Gary, thank you so much for joining us.
Buna ziwa. Is that
Buna
right?
Buna ziwa. Yeah, that's correct. I'm impressed, actually. It doesn't happen often, but you managed
Fantastic.
To surprise me.
That was my goal.
Well, good job.
What a great way to start. So we've got a list of questions. We're excited to be given some time with you. And let's just jump in. We wanted to start with, like, you recently, it looks like, have kind of a new position at Google. It may be relatively new. How do you like this new search relations team? When was that group team formed? And would you say it's fair to say that team is kind of a replacement for Matt Cutts?
And are you just a glutton for punishment, you know?
That's an interesting question. Something that's been brewing for, it's related to something that's been brewing for quite some time. We actually haven't changed teams. We just rebranded ourselves because originally we were called, I think, Webmaster Trends Analyst or Web Trends Analysts. And that's a confusing title. Like, internally, when we were asked, like, what are you doing? It's like, well, we are Web Trends Analysts, so we communicate a lot with external people. And then sometimes we analyze the web. And then people were just, like, really confused about, like, what the heck are we doing? Search relations, that describes better what we are doing, essentially. We just decided to go with that. Nothing really changed internally. Well, nothing at all, except now people can understand easier what are we up to, I guess. And as for the Matt Cutts connection, there was no change there either. Basically, when Matt left, we were brainstorming a lot whether we should have one person who replaces Matt or not. We decided that there will not be one person. Basically, the person who's responsible for web spam position that Matt had initially, that was filled with... by one person. I will not name him because he wants to stay anonymous for reasons. But then the communication side, that was replaced by a whole team. Some folks are less visible. Basically, they don't like the communication side of it. But then there are a few of us, like John, Martin, Daniel, and myself, who don't mind, okay, that's an overstatement, that we don't mind, are okay with communicating externally. But it also means that we cause Twitter wars and meltdowns and all the fun stuff. We also represent Google in court sometimes. It's basically what Matt used to do, except instead of one person being the lightning rod, now there are several.
So I've seen a couple of interviews with you guys, and you really seem to have a lot of fun. I think, you know, I'm wearing a shirt that says sarcasm on it because you're a very proud wielder of sarcasm. Seems like you guys have a lot of fun doing what you're doing. Like, what's it like working on that team?
It's probably a nightmare. so, like, I mean, We've been doing internet stuff for a very long time. Like, if you combine us together, then probably we have over a century experience of internet stuff. So we grew quite cynical of things. So there's lots of cynicism going on when we interact with each other. That doesn't bleed through the public communication, well, not often at least. But then we still want to have fun. So if not cynicism, then what else can you have? And then there's sarcasm. I believe that we are doing quite a good job being sarcastic. it's been pointed out quite often that people who never heard me do public speaking, for example, they would not understand what's happening, and they wouldn't understand why am I saying things and then mean different things. This is especially true in America. When I have public speaking opportunities in the States, then, well, sometimes I confuse people, and then they just quote literally what I said, even though it was just sarcasm on my side.
So Gary, when you were talking about, like, you know, Fred, right, the update Fred, was where did that fall on, sarcasm or cynicism? And if you could talk a little bit about kind of like the experience surrounding that kind of exchange.
So that was cynicism at that point. That was Barry annoying the living heck out of me I don't know, we launched some update on search, and then he's been pestering me about why don't we give it a name, the specific update. And I was like, no, we are not naming these things. It's like, no, we should name them. It's like, no, we are not naming it. And then he was pestering me for a while. And then at one point I just snapped. And I was like, you know what? From going forward, every single freaking update will be just Fred. And that's it. Just Fred. Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
and that people just went with it.
Yeah, I mean, y'all are constantly doing updates, so it's hard to, I guess, keep up with, you know, the naming of all of them.
Right.
Right.
Right. You know? Like choosing specific names for every specific update would be kind of a nightmare.
Yeah.
So it's, I think that what Danny Sullivan, our public search liaison, to name these updates just core updates, and then people stick a name or a month next to the name. That kind of works. I don't think that it was necessary, but if people are happy with it, then
Whatever. I think they just want to kind of point to something of, like, you know, what's changing in the Google Dance and kind of what's going on. People are going, what's going on with the weather, that sort of thing. So I think that that's helpful. You know, wanted to kind of transition away from some of that stuff and kind of talk about more kind of broader views of stuff. Maybe you can speak a little more openly, but, like, you know, one of the big hot things, right? And, you know, SEO used to be a hot term. Now it became kind of a negative term. And then, you know, it kind of constantly changes, but machine learning and AI is really kind of stepping to the spotlight.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing that a lot in, you know, the AdWords side of things, and kind of the learning algorithms and neural networks kind of building better at a lot of these searches. I would be really interested to hear kind of your future of kind of where things are going, you know, and kind of what that kind of guiding star is. I know we can get into EAD and some other things later, but really wanted to hear kind of your broader view of kind of where search is going, where, you know, technology is going as far as search goes. So.
Right. So I honestly, I don't think that machine learning changes, or, no, us using machine learning in search changes all that much externally. Basically, the same rules apply. It's just we are combining signals in ways that we haven't thought of before, for example. And I do think it's making search better in a way that we haven't seen before, or we couldn't think of before. So I do think that from our perspective, this whole machine learning voodoo, it's actually a good thing. I know that SEOs and web professionals in general, they focus a lot on the machine learning aspect of it. I honestly think that they shouldn't, because we don't change the rules or the guidances just because we started using machine learning. We figure out new connections between different things thanks to machine learning, but otherwise everything just stays the same.
So the experience that you're want to provide to the Google user is still the same. This might be a good place to interject. We always say on our podcast, you can go back, you know, we started in 2009. We always say that if you're providing a good experience to the Google user, Google will look favorably upon you. What's your take of that kind of statement?
I mean, it has to be the same, right? But I completely agree with that. And I was a big advocate of that even before I joined Google, like 10 or 11 or whatever years ago, because ultimately that's what users want, a good user experience.
Right. And that can mean a lot of things, but like ultimately, like, we're always thinking, okay, how do you provide that good experience to the Google user, and then like keep doing that and do that more and multiply it.
Right.
Again.
Right. Also, one thing that's funny about this phrase "user experience" is that most people I talk to they refer to user experience when it comes to the layout, for example, of the page and how fast it loads, but the experience of the user doesn't stop there. For example, if I'm reading Wikipedia, let's say that I'm bored and I start reading something about, Emily Bronte, and there's this 3,000-word article, and I keep scrolling, and I get a good experience because it's in sections. I can jump up and down based on what I'm reading. Reread some parts, and then follow links to other Wikipedia articles or even external links. That was a user experience. The thing that I read and how that was written and how I perceived what was written on the page, that's also a user experience. Mm-hmm. Because I'm literally experiencing the content.
So it's the whole thing, really.
Yeah,
the whole thing.
It's not just the layout and how fast the page loads and where you placed ads or whatever. It's also the content itself. And when people think about user experience in relation to Google users, then I would rather they think about the whole package instead of just taking things apart and just like, okay, but user experience is just like how I place the ads here and there and like. Like, no, it's the whole package.
I like that.
Yeah. So we're in the middle, obviously, of a pandemic. We've got COVID.
What? I didn't get that memo.
I mean, if you Googled it, you could find out about it. So what are you guys seeing, any trends that are changing from a search perspective related to COVID? And if you are, are you guys saying, hey, this is something that we need to incorporate long term?
I mean, in the beginning of this whole COVID crap, we had to rethink some of the features that we have. Like for example, the I don't know what the public name is for it. The PSAs, the public service announcements, or like for example, when you search for anything COVID nowadays, you get very specific experience on the search result page, and that we had to build out very fast from a product that was not meant to be used at that scale. Mm-hmm. Like when for example there's an earthquake in California or in Indonesia or whatever, then you normal, like if you search for the earthquake from that location, then you would get like a small box which says that the magnitude was this, the epicentrum was here and whatever. But for COVID, we had to develop a complete experience where people could get relevant information from authoritative sources. That was new. That was triggered by, well, it was both our forward-thinking leaders, search leads, but also the trends that we saw in logs, that more and more people search for COVID-related crap. COVID symptoms, COVID the treatment, COVID vaccine, COVID, I don't know, South Carolina or whatever. Based on that, our path was influenced, basically.
So Gary, if you apply that to kind of like consumer behavior, I know you were on the local team, or I don't know what the right name was it for, but like the Google My Business team, as far as, you know, there was a lot of changes on how people are searching, how people are buying things,
right.
You know, and it looks like that's going to be prolonged with what's going on. Well, maybe not. There's some announcement today that Pfizer has some, you know, cure or whatever, but or vaccination. But you know, like, are you seeing like permanent changes in search behavior? I guess in every update you kind of take that into consideration as things evolve. Can you speak to kind of anything that you're seeing? Or anything that on a broad level that you might be doing, or SEOs or local small businesses maybe would be good advice to take into consideration of kind of what's happening and them needing to change kind of their online presence in a way.
That's a great question. I can only speak for search, web search itself. Well, also video and images, but not for Google My Business. So I don't actually know what they are doing. I see the features that pop up, and I'm amazed that appeared, just like you would be. I'm not getting communications about that. But in search itself, we did have to make some changes. The thing that I talked about, the PSA system, or feature experience, I don't know what would I call it, that was brand new, basically. Almost it was built up almost from scratch. And as for businesses on the internet, I would invest in a shopping cart somehow. I was amazed how quickly certain companies or actually platforms created, for example, shopping carts for those who were hosting with them, and enabled them to continue to remain online even though they had to close their physical stores. But I know for certain that many businesses are not on these platforms. Basically, they can't get a wholesale solution from the platforms that they are using. Because, for example, they are on WordPress, or they are using Joomla, or they are using Blogger, basically platforms that are not specifically created for such things, like selling things, and they are not Well, they are not platforms like Etsy, for example, or WordPress.com, where you can piggyback on whatever was developed for other users, or, well, yeah, users. So I would definitely, like, regardless of what platform are you on, I would try to find a way to sell your thing online. It doesn't have to be a physical thing, obviously. Like, you can sell, I don't know, web stamps or guestbook entries or whatever. But find a way to sell online, because now we know that people are willing to buy online. They are willing to give out their credit card information to random stores. But you have to provide that experience. You have to let them give you your money. And if you don't have a shop, an online shop, then how will you do that? So I would do some research. I don't know, WordPress shopping cart or something like that on your favorite search engine.
Yeah.
And just make it happen, because you do have users and they are willing to buy from you, most likely. You just have to provide them the ability to actually purchase from you.
I think you're right. The speed at which a lot of restaurants made it available to order online when in the past they didn't was like an appropriate response to the situation, but still impressive nonetheless.
I mean, Chris, like even like service-based businesses, right? Like, I mean, I think they need to start thinking about changing how they do business when things are typically like a in-person interaction, right? Gary, I know you kind of mentioned before, and we have it kind of down the list of questions, but image and video, like we're really seeing the incorporation of different kinds of content, really reflective positively in the search engine to enhance that experience. But like, I'm thinking like, you know, service-based businesses that are, you know, SMBs, like they need to provide, or this is what I've been saying, I want to get your kind of input on it to see kind of how that matches up. But I think they need to provide, you know, a virtual showroom, right? And kind of walk them through what would happen if someone came into their showroom to buy that experience, so they can see maybe what they're going to get, or hear some testimonials, see kind of the different products if they're selling, say, windows or doors or something like that, and try to find a way to incorporate virtually as much as possible, because people want to limit interaction, and then you know, having that shopping cart at the end. But you know, some of the data points that I remember, Chris, I can't remember where it was, but 85% of people are through the purchasing decision before they pick up the phone and call you. I would think with COVID, you know, it's even further than that, right? And like, you want to be able to maybe provide that whole experience, no matter what your business is, online.
Yeah. And I would also add that sometimes you will have to think about how to transform the experience, because very often you cannot map the same experience, the same in-store experience, to online. We see this with conferences, for example, and I don't mean to offend anyone, but I yet to see an online conference that can give me the same satisfaction, the same experience that an offline conference can do. Or can give me, because what people are doing is trying to map the offline experience to online, and it just doesn't work. Because like, why would it work? Like, you don't have that person in front of you to read their small gestures, the small mimics on their faces, for example. So you can't actually adjust your
presentation
narrative, I guess, presentation. Like, for example, I don't see that Chris is yawning there, because I just don't see him. If I saw him that he's yawning again, stop doing that.
You would probably get sarcastic.
Yeah, exactly. I would try to wake them up. I would modify my presentation on the stage just to engage with the audience, but I don't see them. So you get sucky presentation from Gary.
Yeah.
well, suckier than usual, but anyway. But yeah, try to think about like, how could you map, well, whether you can map the offline experience to in-store experience to online. And if you cannot, then just brainstorm with your partner about like how to offer something similar or even more immersive.
That's really quite interesting. You can't map everything, right?
Yeah.
You know, really like when you're talking to people, or even like, you know, that goes back to like text messaging or something like that, it can be misinterpreted because you're not reading the full body language of what's going on. Like that brings up something in my head. I'm just kind of going off on a tangent here. You know, I know that, you know, a lot of things are being recorded through video now. I mean, is there any plans of Google to start mapping like eye movement or kind of like whatever these, you know, wearables are doing for how the experience is in search of like how people respond? Because that's something that's extremely lacking. I know that, you know, if you go back to why kind of Gmail and Chrome was going on, is people were spending very few moments on the search when kind of Facebook was launching. And they wanted to understand what the user was doing, not just kind of in the search standpoint, at least from what I've kind of read, that was kind of one of the initial emphasis of why it was being launched. Like now with COVID, everybody's more online, you can grab more data. I'm wondering, is there other kind of dimensions of what Google might be looking at when we're talking about the customer experience? I know that's way off on tangent, and I don't know if you ever thought anything related.
Go.
Really long question, very short answer. Basically, I don't know. I know for certain that we are always on the lookout for new signals that we can use, but I know that we do user studies, in-person user, well, in-person, as in we used to do in-person user studies, where we were doing eye tracking, but that was in a lab environment. Otherwise, I don't know. I don't even know how you would do eye tracking. Sure. Also, it freaks me out that
eye tracking. It totally freaks me out, so I understand. It
makes us a little nervous.
Yeah.
I wanted to kind of go back to AI, and so it's, you said it's, and you may not be able to share this, but you said it's coming up, it's kind of pointing out signals that are very useful that you hadn't kind of come up without AI. Can you share any of those? Is there anything that's standing and you're like, wow, I wouldn't have expected that to have such an impact? Is there anything that you can share? Because that's like really geeky and cool.
I mean, I know of several of them, but I don't think I should share them. So here's one thing. People tend to overthink search and think of search like we are using all these obscure signals and whatever. But very often, those signals are not that obscure, and they are like right in your face. And the problem with those signals is that very often it's very hard to build protections against abuse.
Yes.
When it comes to those signals. So it's kind of like security through obscurity.
Yeah.
Basically, if we don't say, then maybe people will not figure it out. And then we don't have to build massive protection or more robust protections against spam when it comes to those signals. Basically anything that's on an HTML page is a fair game for us to use as a signal. And then you can combine them, of course. And then whether or how you combine them, that might give you new perspectives about where something should rank, for example.
Okay. So one of the things I think you could talk about, maybe, and it's a good time to transition into that, is, you know, eat, right? Like, so that from what I understand is like a simplification of kind of all the different algos that, you know, you're kind of looking at, of kind of that guiding star as we were talking about before. Maybe you can speak a little bit more openly on just kind of eat in general, and what people should be doing for guidance, maybe.
Good question. I would point out that eat itself, basically, I would start off with this: eat itself is not a ranking signal.
Yeah.
So let's take that off the table for the audience. Mm-hmm. What it is is an explanation for humans, basically our raters, about what our algorithms are looking for when it comes to X, quality or whatever. And with that, the best place to learn about EAT is actually the Raters Guidelines that we published and keep updated. If you search for it on your favorite search engine, I'm sure you will find it. I don't have the URL handy. It's a over 150 page long document. It's perfect when you want to fall asleep, because it's utterly boring. I know that I tried to read it several times. I couldn't. It's just it's amazing how boring it is. It's only in English, and that's on purpose. Basically, the raters actually have to speak English. Or read and understand English. So that's why we publish only in English. I don't know if that's new information. But anyway. So if you want to learn more about EAT, then Raters Guidelines. That's your go-to document. If you want to read interpretations of EAT, then there are several people on the interwebs who are kind of on the right track, or are on the right track. One, these people would be, for example, Marie Haynes, Glenn Gabe, Jennifer Slag. They are all pretty versed when it comes to EAT, and generally their interpretation is quite sane. The problem with EAT is that many people try to interpret it, and most of the stuff is batshit stupid. And
is that how you really feel? I just want to gut check there.
I mean, I could try to sugarcoat it if you want.
Oh, I thought that was sugarcoated.
No, that was me.
No, that's fantastic. You know, shifting gears a little bit, you know, like something that I think gets undervalued a lot is image and video search. But based on like the search volume, I see like huge opportunities. And I was curious if you could kind of talk about that on a broad level, but maybe apply it to small businesses, how they might be able to leverage it, or maybe some, you know, examples of people that are doing it right that small businesses could look to, because I just think it's a huge opportunity that in the marketplace, because
right.
How many times can you write a blog about, you know, roofing services in a particular city that's not going to be adding to the knowledge base or relevancy to what's already been written. But on the image or video side, there's a lot of kind of how to explainer and things that you could do to enhance the user experience.
Yeah. Fantastic question. I love both video and image search, mostly because you can discover stuff in a different way. I mean, we've been using web search for over 20 years, and it's been working for us. As humans, quite well. But then sometimes you need a different kind of way to discover things. Like I'm moving apartments right now. Basically, I actually have to have something that is livable if I'm staying put in Switzerland, because normally I would travel because that's my job. Mm. But now we have this freaking COVID crap and I cannot travel. Anyway, so now I'm moving apartments and I needed ideas about how to furnish the place. Like my old apartment is a small studio, so I didn't really have anything in there. Now the apartment is bigger. It's a little bigger, but anyway. But I do need new stuff in the apartment. And I started, as most people would, I imagine, I started with web search, but it was just not doing it for me. And then as soon as I switched to the images tab, suddenly the idea started flowing. I'm a visual type myself, so I can imagine things much easier if I see stuff. Like, for example, if I see Cecil, what's that in English? Wow, reading chair. Mm-hmm. Okay, I could remember in German and not in English. Wow, that sucks. If I see a reading chair, for example, on image search, then I can kind of envision that in the room and how it would look like in the room. But if I'm just doing the four blue links plus the ads plus the whatever, it's rather hard. And I think that's where small businesses can jump in quite aggressively into search results, because I'm fairly certain there are many people like me who are more visual, and then they would prefer to see images of things that people are selling. I was actually following a small business, a local small business, their transition to COVID era, and they are a bakery. They do have an online presence, but it was kind of plain. There was nothing special about it, and honestly, I wouldn't have gone there by myself, I guess, like unless I see an ad or something, and yeah, it just looked weird. And then overnight, they redesigned the whole experience when our first lockdown happened, and they put up lots of images of everything. And soon after that, those images started to show up in image search as well. And then when I was searching, for example, for what's the Gipfeli croissant, for example, then I would get on the second position, whatever that means in image search, their croissant. I recognized it because they have a logo on it, so I it was also like a branding thing for them, yeah, I guess. But I clicked through and I bought a bunch of croissant for the next 2 days from them because I saw them on image search.
Interesting.
Honest, if I would have seen them in web search, I probably wouldn't have clicked through.
So Gary, I mean, on the image search and video search kind of, again, in broad terms, like localization, right? I mean, I'm assuming Google's taking that into consideration with your story, right? Because I think a lot of people have shied away from it because, you know, you say you push a video out on YouTube or you put up an image, like if you can't sell, like geographically across the US or North America or across the world, and you're a local business, you know, you don't know who's going to see those images. But it sounds like to me, based on just your story, Google's taking localization into consideration. Yeah,
we do. I mean, I was working on that team for I don't remember, up to 2 years. I don't actually remember for how long, where we have this signal called LDCP, language demotion country promotion, where we take into account the user's, the searcher's location, and then based on that, we boost results that are geographically relevant to them, and demote results that are in a language that they might not be interested in. So if you are, for example, targeting, French-speaking Canadians, then you can definitely do that just by creating French pages for them. That's really not new, and it's been working like that for the longest time. We do take into account geographic location, both for both of the result and the user.
So I want to ask a question. So can you talk a little bit about Google's decision to include link signals surrounding no followed links, and how does this impact maybe other countries outside the US more?
Interesting. So that was one of my most exciting announcements last year. We don't actually have anything to announce there, but I can certainly talk about like how I envision using that to our advantage. It's worth pointing out that most search engines are treating nofollow as a hint, and they've been doing that for the longest time. Like for example, if I remember correctly, Bing never agreed to use it as a directive, the nofollow signal or whatever annotation. They always said that they would just use it as a hint, and basically that's what we picked up to. We, for reasons I don't know why, we back then in 2006 maybe, we decided that we are just going to use it as a directive, but that also blinded us many aspects. So for example, if you put up nofollow link leading to malware, for example, then we wouldn't have been able to see that because you put a nofollow on the link. Same goes for spam, same goes for pretty much anything. And for us, and for other search engines as well, treating nofollow as a hint basically allows us to discover these things that might be harmful for the users. I don't think that we've ever said that we would want to use nofollow links in ranking specifically, definitely not in the announcement blog post, but that's also a possibility. We know our algorithm is, ranking algorithms still use links quite extensively for ranking purposes, which means that if there are no links, then it's harder for us to, it's not impossible, but certainly harder to rank certain results. And there are areas of the internet, language areas, where there are just not enough links, and that basically makes our results be less optimal. Like for example, if I'm in Indonesia, I used to go to Indonesia a lot because diving. I do speak some Indonesian, so I was searching in Indonesian, and I was amazed how bad the results were. And even for common terms, like where to buy bread or where to buy dabu dabu or this weird, not sauce, but salad sort of thing, And the results were quite awful in quite awful many times. And when I got back from vacation and I started debugging these queries, then it was evident that the reason for that is that it's not that we have a data void, essentially, where there are just no results for, or no good results for those queries. It was that we were not we weren't able to rank those results because, for example, we didn't have enough links. And we didn't understand, we didn't have context, we didn't have link juice, I'm air quoting here, that we could use for ranking. And that's not to say that you now absolutely have to go out and buy links like a crazy person, because we, especially in the English-speaking, or on the, in the English-speaking internet, we have countless examples for sites ranking without links at all, like without incoming external links. Because here the internet is more mature. We understand the web much better because, well, we've been operating on the English internet for longer, for much longer. So you can absolutely rank without links, but in certain areas, it's just much harder.
Well, and that's probably related to, like, if there aren't that many sites that have the content that fulfills the query, then, you know, great, you can rank without the links. But if you are in a competitive environment, the links start to become significantly important. Like, that just makes sense.
I mean, even in competitive competitive queries, it's certainly possible. One of my favorite examples comes from a conference where this person, external person, was saying exactly the same thing, that you don't necessarily need links to rank well. And the thing that he brought up was car brand purchase or something like that. Commercial query for a car brand. The first result was from the brand itself. It's a smaller brand, so it's, I guess it's fairer, more fair. Then he was doing live link analysis on that specific result. And it was just, it just had no links, no external links whatsoever.
Was it a big site? Did it have a lot of links? No, it's a small site. Yeah.
It was a small site. The brand was clear. But then if you are online and you want to stay online, then you probably eventually will have to build out your brand. Anyway, mm-hmm. It just worked for them. And then he showed, I don't remember, 3, 4, 5 more examples where he was showing head queries where these tools like, I wanted to sound smart and now I don't know these tools. I don't know, Screaming Frog, that's a link analysis tool. Yeah, okay. Wow, oh. High five. it's internal. Oh, well, that's great. Anyway, so these link analysis tools couldn't find any external links pointing to those pages that showed up in the pole position. So it's definitely possible to do it. You just have to have good experience if we want to loop back to the beginning of the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the on page. Let me ask you this: like, you kind of brought up something you were talking about, maybe more fair, like based on kind of difficulty of search terms. You know, we deal with a lot of small businesses that we work with, and it seems to be competingly difficult to compete with the bigger brands. And I've read some things about how y'all try to kind of make it more fair. Can you speak to maybe any of those things or any kind of guidance to small business owners of how they can still continue to compete with these bigger brands with not the budget and internal team and,
right.
And things like that to still keep a level playing field in search.
Right. So I will go back to my bakery example here because it's a small bakery. It's one of the more obscure bakeries. And we have several chains here that would happily ship me croissants at a better price. This small bakery managed to beat those chains. One thing that they did really well is to recognize that there are visual types and they optimize their images so they have more surfaces where they can come up in search results. That's one thing. The other thing is that they do something special. They are specializing in croissants. They are not trying to sell me all the kinds of breads and pretzels and croissants and bear claws and Danish whatever. They are just specializing in croissants. But their croissants are epic. They are absolutely epic. I don't know how they make them. Like, I can make croissants. I bake a lot. I can make croissants, but I have no idea how they make it. But it's just, they are just epic. There were two things that happened. One was that people talked about their croissants in relation to the brand name that they have. They were sharing the brand on social media. They were writing about them on Facebook and Twitter and whatever. They didn't link, but that's not necessary in many cases. They provided a painless experience for the users to actually get the croissants. They were the first ones, I believe, the first bakery to offer close to instant delivery within the city of Zurich, meaning that they were hiring people to deliver by bikes or using bikes. The croissants. Basically, they took out the oven, the croissants, and delivered it to your doorstep within 10, 15 minutes.
Wow.
And that basically, that was what made them amazing and why people talked about them. So you have to think, like when you are online, there are many sites like yours, most likely. It doesn't matter what you do. It's very likely that there's already a site like yours. What you have to do is sit down with whoever you are working with your partner, with your friends, with your relatives, probably not with your dog, and start talking to them, start brainstorming about how could you stand out? Because let's be honest, like it's hard to be special mm-hmm. on the internet. And it's very likely that you are not going to become special alone. You will need help. But the help that you need is more people who can give you ideas. So talk to people. How would you make this business more special? It might be that you send a red rose with a bottle of wine that people are buying from you. It might be that you do instant deliveries. It might be that, you just include a personalized handwritten note with every purchase. But you have to come up with something special that will make people remember you. Because if they remember you, then their friends will remember you as well by extension, because they will talk about you.
Yeah, that's awesome. So really, you're talking about the overall brand experience, something that we talk about at EWR on a regular basis. And really, this kind of goes back to, I mean, we're talking with a search expert, and his recommendation was deliver a red rose with your wine. Like that goes back to the business and the brand that you're trying to project to your customers. That's pretty phenomenal. We're about out of time. I don't know if you have a time limit right now, or because we've got a couple more questions, or we can end it here.
Go for it.
Excellent. Matt, did you have something that you wanted to jump in, or?
Yeah, no, I definitely have a few more questions. I want to just make sure to leave enough time for if there's anything Gary wants to kind of communicate. I want to make
sure. I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't have anything on my mind right now. Other than food.
I guess schema kind of here changed recently, and I don't know if you can kind of speak to kind of, you know, why y'all changed kind of, you know, what you're looking for, or like we've started to kind of restructure kind of the schema that we've been doing on a few sites based on some of the stuff we've seen. I don't know if you can speak anything to kind of schema in general, or kind of what you're looking at there.
Are you talking about the tool change?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think there's a slight misunderstanding there in general, because we haven't actually changed anything about schema. What we changed is what and how the tool interprets. Because historically, that tool was validating any kind of schema that you threw at it. From our perspective, that was not necessarily optimal, because then people were like, okay, here's this obscure schema. Why are you not using it in search? And then we were like, well, because we don't want to. It's like, yeah, but then the tool is validating it. So what up with that? And it's like, it was just these really weird conversations. So what we did was switching the tool to only validate schema that we are using in search for visual features.
Okay.
I pointed out visual features because there are two ways we use schema in general in search result. Well, in search, one is for visual things, like for example, recipe carousel or software carousel, and I forgot what else. But we are also using it in general for understanding the entities on the page. And that's not visual. That happens in the background. It will potentially make search results better, but it's not like people will have a direct benefit from those schema. Those schema are actually much simpler to validate, and basically any validation tool could do it that is following the schema.org. I don't know what they are, recipes or whatever. So technically from our side, we don't, like, if you are following a schema.org well, schema.
Yeah.
You are already on in the good. You can use some other tool to validate those. And if you are targeting a specific search feature, visual search feature, then for that you have the rich whatever testing tool.
Okay. I also have a question. Chris and I have had some interesting conversations on the podcast about AMP.
Ooh.
Kind of the future of AMP, and then one of the things.
How can you have interesting conversations about AMP? Go ahead, Matt.
something that we're starting to see, and we haven't implemented it yet, but, you know, like AMP carousels, kind of the little preview pages. Load time, I know, is just one of the signals, but it's a pretty dang important one, I believe, to user experience. Because if you're on mobile and the page doesn't load, you know, you're going to click out pretty quick. But can you speak to the future of AMP and any of your thoughts on kind of the AMP carousels that are starting to kind of pop up?
Wow. The short answer is no. The longer answer is that as a user, very often I prefer AMP. Very often I'm actively looking for the little AMP icon or badge or whatever it is. And even before we announced it and we already talked about it internally, I was actually super excited about it because I felt that it can provide an experience which can be better than whatever you can provide on your site using traditional coding. Very often people overload their site with many kinds of frameworks, for example, JavaScript frameworks, out of which they will use only one or two functions or instructions, which is like, the heck are you doing? But anyway, so AMP could definitely help with that. And also the caching, that's phenomenal for users. For webmasters or SEOs or web professionals in general, it can generate some overhead because, you have to implement it. But then if you are on a platform like or CMS like WordPress, for example, then you basically install a plugin and you already have it. Yep. So it's not that bad. I definitely think that in many cases, it can still provide a much better user experience than whatever people can do on their website, but it's not necessarily true all the time. You can definitely nowadays create an experience that is very close to AMP, basically create a snappy experience just by doing some prefetching, for example, or optimizing what you are loading into the web page, and basically not overloading with crappy frameworks your poor site. So it's we are getting there already, even without AMP. And I think that that was one important role of AMP, basically making web professionals realize that people are actually looking for snappier things, where things is pages, web pages. And they started optimizing those pages. There were many people who were just switching to AMP or implementing AMP on top of the HTML that they already had and that already helped people. But then there were people who were, or web professionals who were not quite AMP friendly, for example. And then what they were doing is optimizing their pages to load faster because, well, they needed to keep up with AMP or whatever AMP could offer for users, for their users. So I kind of feel that it in some sense, it started a revolution and it moved the needle of the loading times to a much more green section of the little dial. And we are in a better place nowadays. One of my pet sites that I will not name, but it's CNN, it used to load in over a minute. Basically, it was just loading something. I was not even looking at one point like what it was loading, but their developers invested a lot into speeding up the site. And I believe that that was partially because of AMP, because every other news site was creating this snappy experience where you could just click on a result and under a second, you would get a result, basically a page where you could consume or experience the content. But if you were loading for over a minute, or you could have first paint in only 15 seconds, then it's very likely that that click goes to somewhere else, right? I mean, if you are into CNN-like sites, then maybe you would go to Washington Post. If you are WSJ, then you would go to I don't know, Fox News or whatever. I don't actually know. I'm making stuff up here. So yeah, I feel that it kind of started a revolution, and the web got in, or it's in a much better shape than it was a few years ago, speed-wise. I think that the team wants to eventually build on that momentum, and perhaps evolve AMP, maybe. I don't know. I'm not on the AMP team, so I don't actually know what their plans are. But on their websites, they usually publish their plans. They are not as secretive as Search.
Chris, I have two more quick questions.
I've got one to follow up on that. So
yeah,
just overall, when you're actually using the web, what's your biggest pet peeve, right? So you hinted there a little bit about time and load times, but what's like overall your nightmare experience when you're experiencing the web?
Freaking pop-ups.
Yeah.
So actually there are quite a few, I think. So pop-ups, that's one thing. I loathe pop-ups, and I just don't see like why would people do that, because at this point, I would be surprised if you could convert really well with pop-ups. Because, I mean, everything has a lifetime, and I would think that people got used to pop-ups enough that they just close them at this point. So I know for certain that their conversion rate was amazing, but I'm not sure that that's still the case, mainly because people went blind. Mm-hmm. Pop-up blind,
yeah.
As in. The second thing is that everyone thinks that they need 3,000 plus words on a page to rank. And this is very obvious on recipe sites, where basically you start from Adam and Eve and you go through how Moses got the tablets, and then you end up at Julius Caesar, yeah. And then eventually you will end up at the bottom of the page in three lines, basically how to make croissants. And I think that's batshit stupid. And I know why people do it, but it is crazy. You don't need to do that. Especially for your own recipes. Like, for example, if you come up, like, of course, if you're copying recipes, then you probably need to compete somehow with the other site you copied the recipe from. So you might need those basically first chapter of Wuthering Heights. But otherwise, it's like it's just batshit crazy. Like, no one wants that. Those are the two things that I'm absolutely nuts about. I unfortunately got a little used to slow loading websites, so that's not bothering me too much anymore, unfortunately. But those long-winded articles about nothing and then three lines on the bottom about something, that does bother me. And pop-ups, that's just no.
Make them go away.
Chris, great question. Two more quick questions if we have time for it.
I have five more minutes.
Okay.
To spare.
One more question. So say a company is changing their name, changing mm-hmm. their site structure, changing their domain, changing really everything about their brand, but maybe that brand's been around, say, 20 years.
Right.
You know, like, I know in Search Console, you can kind of switch it over and it'll carry over some of the link history, maybe. But, you know, what kind of recommendations would you give to companies that are maybe rebranding to keep up with the times, or they're maybe they purchased a brand,
right,
and they're incorporating it into their initial brand of how to carry some of that stuff through. Is there any kind of place to look for best practices, or, you know, any kind of recommendations you would give there? Because really everything that I've read, like, there's kind of a threshold that if you change enough stuff, Google's going to consider it a brand new site, no matter kind of what you do. And I just wanted to hear kind of from the horse's mouth.
that's only partially true, because if you are using the Sitemove tool in Search Console, then that will just move all the signals over to the new site, unless you are doing something spammy, in which case we will choose to ignore that. So I would definitely use that that tool in Webmaster Tools, because that in Search Console, because that's the thing that will make the signals transfer. I think one thing that many people forget when they are rebranding, for example, is how actually people work, or how their brain works. And I was tweeting about that, and I caused a little meltdown on Twitter, because the story behind the tweet was that I got an email about basically someone was phishing email addresses, and somehow they found mine. And it was a rant about how after a week we are still showing the old name for the site, even though they rebranded in our results. And I just lost it a little, because it's like I will never do that. Like, here there's a company called or used to be a company called Cablecom, basically the cable company. And then at one point they were purchased by UPC. But people, my friends, they are still calling that same company Cablecom, because that's what we called them for 10 years.
Yeah.
We are not calling them UPC, even though that would be the correct term. We are calling them Cablecom. Why? Well, because Cablecom never actually UPC never actually invested into teaching people the new reality that it's not Cablecom anymore, it's UPC. They are still branding some of the bills that they are sending as Cablecom member of UPC or whatever. I don't actually know how to translate it, but they are still showing Cablecom on their bills. Sometimes it shows up in ads that and then they are amazed that people are still calling the company Cablecom and not UPC. It's like, duh. Like, you're even telling people that it's still Cablecom. Like, why would people call you UPC when you are not doing a good job calling yourself UPC? So I would invest traditional marketing in just teaching people that you've changed. And that's a very psychological thing. It's probably not going to happen overnight. It definitely won't happen in 1 week. But eventually, you can teach people to call you something else. I mean, our brain can still be taught. It's quite quite easy to teach the brain new things, especially simple things like this. And it can work, but it takes time and it needs investment. Like, you cannot expect people to call you something else unless you tell them repeatedly that they should call you something else.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, we're kind of at your time limit. So we want to thank you very much for taking the time, spending it with us. Do you want to share with our audience, like, how they could connect with you, or resources or thing? Is there anything you'd like to share?
Well,
that's your email address.
So actually my email address is public, because we published something on IETF as a draft standard. And so people could find my email address. I'm just not answering most of the emails that I get, because I don't have time. What do I want to share? Let's see. Well, don't eat yellow snow. That's one thing. Second thing is that if you have questions or comments about our work, please find John Mueller on Twitter and complain to him. I'm also on Twitter, but please don't yell at me because I'm a snowflake and I would just go in my corner and start crying. And I don't like crying, so don't do that. But don't be surprised if I'm mean to you because, well, I'm just mean in general.
As the purveyor of sunshine, I like that. We'll wrap up the podcast with humming. Again, Gary, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful rest of the year. Hopefully this COVID crap will go away in some form or another.
Right.
Fingers crossed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Multimask.
Thank you for having me.
Multimask. Did I say it right?
No. Finally.
Thank you so much.
It's Multimask.
Multimask. Yeah. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.